But I just want to welcome everybody here tonight. This is our 33rd annual German Swiss Genealogical Society meeting. We've been doing this for 33 years, starting on 34. I'm so glad that everybody could come tonight. The weather was kind of poor, and a few people I think didn't make it. But I see the Hutto's made it. We were looking for you guys. And I'm just so glad that everybody made it tonight safely. And I hope you all get back home tonight safely. But when we, of course, you know, we've had a few problems finding a venue since we couldn't have it at our usual venue. And this year, I wanted to have it here at the Episcopal Church, not Episcopal now, Church of the Redeemer, because it's such a historic church, and the roots of the church are very deep with the people of Orangeburg. And tonight we're privileged to have Reverend Dr. Larissey with us, and he's going to speak about the church and about the history of the church. And I thought before he started his talk, I'd like to tell you guys a little bit about him. He's a native South Carolinian, born in Charleston. He was the middle of five children and the son of the late Walter Earl Larissey Jr. and Virginia Myrick Larissey. We discussed the Myricks. Some of you have some Myrick connections. I know I do. I have a few. He attended public schools and graduated from Middleton High School in Charleston in 1972. Dr. Larissey matriculated at the University of South Carolina, but then transferred to the University of the South at Suwanee, Tennessee. He graduated from the University of the South with a Bachelor of Science degree in biology in 1977. After teaching biology for 3 years, he applied and was accepted as a postulant for holy orders from the Episcopal Diocese of Tennessee and attended Virginia Theological Seminary in Alexandria, Virginia. He graduated from Virginia Seminary with a Master in Divinity degree. Dr. Larissey was ordained to the diaconate in 1983 and served as curate to the rector of St. David's Episcopal Church from July 83 till June 84. In May of 84, he was ordained to the priesthood in the Episcopal Church and was appointed as vicar of St. Columba's Episcopal Church in Bristol, Tennessee. After serving for several years in Columba, he was called to serve several churches in Columbia, South Carolina, Atlanta, Georgia, Clemson, and Peachtree City, Georgia. In 1995, he began doctoral studies at Columbia Theological Seminary in Decatur, Georgia, but later changed doctoral programs and transferred to the theological school at the University of the South. As an augmentation to the program, he completed a one-year residency in clinical pastoral education at Grady Memorial Hospital in Atlanta, Georgia. And after receiving 4 units of credit, he continued with his ministry at St. Andrew's. He continued with his ministry at St. Andrew's Episcopal Church in Peachtree City, Georgia. In May of 2005, he finished his doctoral studies and received his doctorate of ministry degree from the School of Theology of the University of the South, Suwanee, Tennessee. In June 2005, Larissey was called to become the rector of the Episcopal Church of the Redeemer, Orangeburg, South Carolina. He has 2 daughters from a former marriage, Rachel and Rebecca, and they are both students at Berry College in Rome, Georgia. Dr. Larissey is married to Hope Martha Larissey, and they reside in Orangeburg here with their 2 dogs. And I can relate to that because I have 3 dogs. But we are indeed proud to have you speak to us tonight. You're a fine man, and a lot of you already know Dr. Larrabee. He's a pillar of the community. So without any other further ado, I will turn the floor over to you, Dr. Larrabee.
Thank you. Thank you, friends, neighbors, fellow Orangeburgians, and others from off. May I ask, how many of you here live in Orangeburg? Please raise your hands. Orangeburgers. Okay. How many of you are South Carolinians from other places? Okay, we've got some. How many are from outside of the state? Oh, we've got a few. Now, who's from Georgia? Oh, I got some Georgians here. North Carolinians? All right, North Carolina. Tennessee. Oh, no, Florida. Okay, Floridians. Okay, great. Wonderful to have everybody here. I pray that tonight, that in this presentation, I don't put you to sleep. But if you start yawning, you know, I'll see that as a clue. Okay? And I'll bring it to a quick close. Tonight's presentation will be both show and tell, somewhat of a teaching, and then a pilgrimage. Because about halfway through this presentation tonight, I'm going to ask you to get up from your comfortable chairs and follow me into the church, because I'm going to do some teaching there and show you the Church of the Redeemer and tell you some things about it. A lot of fun, I hope. Most of what I'm getting ready to tell you is already printed in this document that I have up here on the podium. You are welcome to a copy, okay, of one of these up here on the podium. Please come get it if you'd like to. There's a lady in our church. Her name is Peggy Dukes Dickinson. She died in 1974 of complications of poliomyelitis. But she was a very lovely lady, very smart, educated, and loved this church and wrote a history of it. It's basically the only modern history of the Church of the Redeemer, and it's well worth reading because it brings in other things about Orangeburg and the locale that I think you'll find very entertaining. Now, I am going to be doing some... No, I've got some notes here. I usually don't like to use notes, but I mean, I've got so much to share. I'm going to use something. I'm going to tell you some things that are not in here as well. Might even crack a few jokes. Now, I don't know if you'll think you're funny or not, but I'll try. Anyway, we begin with why Orangeburg is Orangeburg. And we have to go back to the British monarchy in order to find that out. We know back in 1714, Queen Anne of England and her husband George of Denmark, well, by 1714, they were both dead. And they had 17 children. Can you believe it? 17 children who died before they did. Who died in childbirth, who died of young diseases, who died of plague. I mean, just all kind of things. Just amazing. They have children, 17 children, but they both outlived their children. And when Queen Anne died, Parliament was scratching its head in 1714. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? And so they looked far and wide to the closest relative to an English monarch, James I, who was still living, a closest relative to him who was still alive, and Protestant, wouldn't go for a Roman Catholic. And where they lighted was across the seas in Germany. They found that James I's first daughter, Elizabeth, had married a Bohemian prince. And they had had a daughter, Sophia, and she'd married a Hanoverian prince. And they had had a son. And this Hanoverian prince, he had another title other than the Prince of Hanoveria. He was also known by an ancient title given to his family. He was known as the Prince of Orange. Ah, and that's where we come to closer to home. Sophia and her husband's progeny was named George. And George was the great-grandson of James I of England. So they said, oh, you're it. I mean, watch out who your genealogy is. Somebody may come after you and say, oh, by the way, we need you to represent, you know, you never know. Great-grandson of James I, and they tagged him to be the next king of England. And he went. And, of course, part of his title was as well the Prince of Orange. And he had a little boy, Georgie II. And Georgie was actually the Prince of Orange, after which Orangeburg is named. King George I died in 1727, and by that time George II was a grown man, and he took the throne. And there had already been discussions about having a township, at least a trading post, up the Edisto River, about 65 or 75 miles west-northwest of Charlestown, to be a buffer against the Indians, to be a help for the fur trade, etc., etc., down the river. And so they looked around and decided, what were they going to name this town? And, of course, Orangeburg, after the Prince of Orange. Now, remember, the Prince of Orange has these German connections. He's the German king. Now, there was no Germany yet, right? There were the Germanies, all these groups of people who spoke German, but had duchies and little dukedoms and even kingdoms that made up Greater Germany. And George II looked around and said, who am I going to send to people this new colony? And of course, he could have looked in England and his fellow Englishmen, but he looked back to Germany. And I just learned tonight that in his looking and in his sending out word and seeking to find settlers for this new establishment, there was a French Swissman, a Swissman who spoke French, who got excited about it, began to talk up around Switzerland, and it kind of crossed over into the German-speaking part of Switzerland, and those folks got interested, as well as people in Germany, and they all made their way somehow to Rotterdam and got on a ship and sailed over to Charlestown. And they eventually ended up settling Orangeburg and making it the city that it is. Along with these folks came two Lutheran pastors. One, an old man, and I believe that I've got my German right, and say that his name was John Ulrich Giesendonner. I believe it was Giesendonner. Never say die, say D, it was G-I-E. Okay, I think I've got that right, Giesendonner. And he started the church, a Lutheran church here in Orangeburg. He was only the pastor there from 1737 to 1738, and then he died. But thank goodness he had his young nephew with him, who was also a Lutheran pastor, the Reverend John Giesendonner Jr., his brother's son, to follow up and to keep the ministry going. The elder Giesendonner started as, you know, all Germans. You know, they're very methodical. They keep records. He started a record with a great record book, you know, bound in leather, about the marriages, the births, the deaths, and the general goings-on about Orangeburg in his record books. And in fact, it's one of the best records of Orangeburg that's in existence, this record that the Giesendonner pastors started. They built the church. Now, they said in the record that it was made out of wood and mud. Basically, that means it was a log cabin, okay? It was a log cabin church. And they put it in kind of the middle part of old Orangeburg. I've got right here a map. It said that there was a map published in 1771 by John Cook of the old Orangeburg township. I have in my hands right here an 1833 copy of that 1771 map. Okay? And you know where the square presently is in Orangeburg? It's on Russell Street, up kind of in this part of the map. But the old square was down on Broughton Street as it begins to go down into that flat part. That was the square. Broughton ran into it. That's the square right there. And then up on this
little here near a hill nearby. It's up this hill, almost across the street, up a little bit, was a graveyard. Now, if you go to Middleton Street toward the post office, and you know, you look left, there's the Historical Society, right, of Orangeburg. And come up behind it on that little rise is graveyard. That's where the original graveyard was for Orangeburg, and the church, that log cabin church, was right next door to it. Either where the Historical Society now is, or across the street, but it's been right close to it. No one's exactly sure, I think. And by the way, y'all correct me if I'm wrong. I'm going to be talking a lot tonight about things that you probably know more about than I do, okay? But I'm just trying to help you along. Anyway, we've got this map in our library. It's very helpful, useful, about old Orangeburg and how it was laid out. And the church was a simple part of it. I mean, it was the church founded by the Seisenmeyer brothers.
I mean, relatives in Orangeburg. It was a church for the community. Because, hey, they were German, right? Swiss. They were Lutheran. They were Protestants. All right? Well, you know, it's hard to found a church out in the middle of the wilderness and to be a pastor there. I mean, it was wilderness, okay? Not much money, hard to get along, get on. And John Giesendonner Jr. began to see what side of the bread the butter was on. And he said, you know, this is an English colony. And I'll bet that if I go to the Church of England and ask to be ordained, they might ordain me and I'd get some money for my church. That's exactly what he did. He went and hopped on a boat, went over to London in the early 1740s, left his church behind, said, guys, I'll do fine, keep praying, I'll be back in a couple of years. He went to seminary, and in 1747, the Right Reverend Dr. Sherlock, the Bishop of London, ordained him to the diaconate and then to the priesthood. At this time, the Bishop of London was in charge of all of the Anglican clergy over in the colonies. South Carolina, Virginia, up into New England. There's the Church of England, right? And what was neat about this is that if you were a Church of England pastor, you got a stipend from the Church of England. They paid you for doing this, wearing that collar and preaching and teaching those things. And when you got back home to the colonies, and remember that, you know, South Carolina was a British colony, if you were the Church of England church in a British colony, you got some perks. I'll tell you what they were in a minute. So John hopped on the boat, came back home, talked to his Lutheran congregation, and said, you know what? You're going to be Anglicans. And there's going to be some real benefits about being Anglicans. You know, if you were an Anglican church and the only one in that township, your governing board, and in the Anglican church we call our governing board a vestry, the vestry became the town council. The vestry had the power to levy taxes. The vestry had the power to enforce tithing. You did not tithe, you get sent to jail. 10% of your income to God through his church. Thank you. Or else jail time for you. I mean, it's a good gig if you can find it, right? Anyway, it helped the church to survive and to do well. Well, John Giesendonner led that church in 1749. It had 107 members of the church. He did well, but then he died. And the second minister of this now Anglican church in Orangeburg was the Reverend Paul Turquand, and he served until the outbreak of the Revolutionary War. Now I want to tell you for a minute about the outbreak of that war and what that did for Anglican churches in South Carolina. I mean, remember, this is the Church of England, and the colonies are at war with England. And everybody looked at any Anglican church, Church of England church, with a little suspicion, especially if they were patriots. You know, hey, you're Church of England, you know, you're the bad guys. But remember that the Anglican church produced some of the greatest patriots on our side in the war. Like George Washington was an Anglican
and the Church of England, George Washington, and Francis Marion Swan Fox, and many, many others. I'll tell you what I think happened. That in the along the coast of South Carolina, where there are a lot of Anglican churches, churches like St. Michael's, St. Philip's down in Charleston, Old St. Andrews, Christ Church Mount Pleasant, St. James Island, in these churches, they survive, right? I think one of the reasons they survived was that a great majority of their congregation were patriots. Even though they were Church of England, they were patriots. They wanted independence from England for political reasons. And that's why they survived. The church here in Orangeburg, the Anglican church here, did not. And I can only guess about why they did not survive. My guess is that the members of this church were Tories. That's my guess. As the most vocal, the most, you know. Anyway, the ones who were really movers and shakers in that church were probably Tories, but after the end of the war, they either ran off to Bermuda or the Caribbean or to Canada, and the church fell into disuse. There are stories about this old log cabin church that had just fallen in on itself, a mound of wood and mud. But there are also stories and family histories of families who kept praying with this Book of Common Prayer. Anglicans who maintained that worship. Even though they didn't have a church anymore, they had the Book of Common Prayer. It would have been the 1662 Book of Common Prayer of England, where they prayed for the king. But, you know, in your own home, nobody cares, right? And you're across the sea. Anyway, but Anglicanism, I believe, stayed alive here in Orangeburg because in the
middle 1800s, about 1847, there was an Anglican church up the road in St. Matthew's. Oh, up the road, that way, in St. Matthew's. And the Reverend Schindler thought, you know, I think we should plant an Anglican church in Orangeburg. In fact, there are some Anglicans there. There's some Episcopalians by this time. If there are some Episcopalians in Orangeburg, I think we can start a church there. And he tried, and it failed. A few years later, in 1851, the rector of St. Matthew's up the road in St. Matthew's, the Reverend Benjamin Johnson, he made plans to open a church, an Episcopal church here in Orangeburg, which is an Anglican church. And he was going to call it the Church of the Redeemer. It kind of caught wind. Steam picked up. People began to worship. There was a lovely lady named Mrs. Catherine Palmer who owned a plantation. And she decided to give some of her land, which was on Boulevard, now present day Boulevard, it was called the Old Stagecoach Road, right across the street from present day South Carolina State University and Claflin College, right across the street from that. She gave a plot of land for this church. And St. Peter's Church down in Charleston donated $125 for this church. And St. Philip's donated $37. And somebody, we don't know who, donated a silver communion set, a Bible, and a prayer book. And the church was off and running. Now, when I say a communion set, I mean something like this. This is a chalice. It has real diamonds in it and sapphires. It bears the blood of Christ in communion, the wine which is the blood of Christ. And these are cruets for carrying the wine and the water. Remember Jesus when he was on the cross in John's Gospel, he was stabbed after he was dead, and what came out of his side? Blood and water. Okay? Water for cleansing as well as to adding to the cup. And this is a lavabo bowl. It's for washing a priest's fingers in before he serves communion. And this is a patent. A plate for serving communion, the body of Christ, the bread, and there. Something like this would have been given, okay, for the start of this church. In 1856, Reverend Wagner became the minister of this church. The church was finally put together, was built, it was constructed, and in 1857 the wooden structure was blessed and consecrated by Bishop Davis of the Diocese of South Carolina. And then in 1860, a very important priest named the Reverend Dr. Paul Trapier came to become the rector of the Church of the Redeemer. He did something unusual. He began to offer two services of worship on Sunday, where everybody else was offering one service of worship on Sunday. Why? Well, there's a very important reason. Now I'm going to have a little bit of show and tell, and so and I don't know. I've got to wear any vestments, but at least I'll show them to you, okay? Paul Trapier was influenced by what was called the Oxford Movement over in England, or another word for it is the High Church Movement. Starting in the 1840s, 50s, 60s, 70s in England, there was this move to push Anglicanism, which had become very Protestant, well, Presbyterian-like, you might say, Methodist-like, though that came later. Anyway, the Anglican Church was very Protestant-like, and there was a move to push them back toward the ancient Catholic forms, more like the Greek Orthodox Church, the Russian Orthodox Church, the Roman Catholic Church. Now, the Church of England had for 400 years, when a priest dressed up like a priest, he would wear this to the service. Oh, it gets complicated. Anyway, this is a Catholic, a black Catholic, and over that, he would wear this white surplice, it's called. A surplice. And then over the white surplice, he would put on this hood. Now, this is a doctoral hood, my doctoral hood, but he put a hood over that. And then over that, he would put, finally, this black thing called a tippet. And that's how he would celebrate. That's how he would preach, leave the services, dressed like this, okay? Very Protestant. Very low church. Okay? And what priests usually did, what the Church of England had come to do in its worship, was that most of the times when you came to church on Sunday, you would have what was called morning prayer. People would come in, they'd sing hymns, and then there would be these beautiful prayers and psalms and Bible readings and gorgeous prayers that Thomas Cranmer had written. And then finally a long sermon, kind of like tonight. And then finally a final hymn and you go home. Okay? And that's how it was most of the time. Four times a year, you had Holy Communion, the body and blood of Christ. You had the Lord's Supper four times a year, okay? Well, there was a move in this high church movement, this Oxford movement, to be more like the Roman Catholics and the Orthodox and have communion every Sunday. Every Sunday? What will we do? And even to look Roman Catholic, to put candles on the table. You know, it was called a holy table. You know, the Roman Catholics called it an altar. What do you call it? Don't call it that. Put candles on it and begin to dress up. That a priest, instead of wearing these things, would wear something like this. This is called a chasuble. And to wear a colored stole, okay? Looks very Roman Catholic-like. And then on High Holy Feast days, to wear this. This is called a coat, okay? And Father Paul Trapier, I mean, he was really going off the deep end, wanting to take Church of the Redeemer and move it in that direction of being one of those high churches, okay? Now, he couldn't convince his congregation very easily. I mean, they weren't going to do that. But he said, I'll tell you what. I want to have communion, the Lord's Supper, every Sunday, and I'm going to do it. But you don't have to come if you don't want to. I'm going to offer it at 8 o'clock in the morning. If you want to come and have Holy Communion with me, come at 8 o'clock in the morning, you can have it. And then at 10 o'clock for everybody else, you come and we'll have morning prayer like we usually do. And, you know, and people said, well, I guess that's not too bad. You know, we can get what we want, you get what you want. And then the Holy Compromise was established. From that time forward, in Anglican churches or Episcopal churches, we have the 8 o'clock service and then the next one. And it started there, you know, this year in Orangeburg. Anyway, I just thought it might be nice to know about something about the Oxford movement. But Father Paul Trapier moved Church of Redeemer to two services. They bought a bell. And the bell is still out there. You know, you can see it in the front of the church because it hangs outside. But it was a bell bought in Philadelphia. But it was actually forged in New York in 1832. And we've still got it. And we ring it from time to time. Lovely bell. They put that there. Everything was going fine. It was 1860. They built a residence for the church, for the clergy. They took up money for a manse, if you will, called a rectory for the clergy, and it was nice. And then along came the Yankees.
You know, they call it the war between the United States. Of course, we down here in Southern, it's called the War of Northern Aggression. I mean, all we wanted to do was leave, and they wouldn't let us, okay? Anyway, there was that fire, it's worth over. Anyway, what can I say? The war between the states came,
and that was really tough. Mr. Lucas, who was on the governing council of the Church of the Redeemer, he was the secretary of the vestry. He wrote in 1862, "The church is filled each Sunday. Most of the congregation are refugees from the Low Country. Sad to see so few men in the congregation and so many ladies in mourning." That was Orangeburg in 1862, but by 1864, things had gotten really bad.
I told some of the folks here, the story I'm going to tell you next, one of my dear friends back in Atlanta, a guy named Graham McDonald, knew that I was moving to Orangeburg about 8 years ago, and he said, "Frank, I want you to see something." And he pulled out this beautiful little leather notebook about that big. It was pretty small, leather. Lovely. And it had a metal stylus. I think it was a silver stylus, but it wasn't a pen. It was a pencil with lead in the middle, okay? And I opened it up, and old pages, but lovely, well-bound. And it was the kind of page that you flip up, you know, it looked very modern. And he said, "This belonged to my great-great-grandfather, who carried it every day in the last year of the war, when he fought on the side of the Confederacy. And in that diary," it is a diary of day-by-day events, almost every day for a year, going from 1864 to 1865 at the end of the war. It starts with me in Savannah, defending Savannah from the Yankees, and then they have to move across the river and flee, and they go to Charleston to help Charleston in its defense. And then they hear the Sherman's coming, and they have to leave Charleston, and they flee up the railroad to Orangeburg. And he writes this wonderful phrase, in like two or three pages, about Orangeburg, where he says, "And on the train he came into this lovely town of beautiful homes and striking churches, beautiful striking churches. And I know that one of the churches he saw from the railroad lines was the Church of the Redeemer over there on Boulevard across the street from Blackwood College. That's one of the churches he saw. How cool." He talked about the generosity and the gentility of the population, how hospitable they were. They invited the soldiers into their homes. They fed them. They couldn't have been nicer. Wonderful people here in Orangeburg. He writes about it, two or three pages. And I just wanted you to know that is how he saw Orangeburg. And if I can find it, I've got a copy of it at my house. I have a Xerox copy. Then it's going to go to the Historical Society. You know, I'm in the midst of kind of getting things together and pulling. You'll get it soon. Anyway,
Orangeburg went through a horrible time. Sherman came through. You know, he burned the town. They broke into the Church of the Redeemer and they stole the church Bible, the prayer book, and the silver communion set. And I believe to this day that there is some northern home
with a curio cabinet, with a lovely chalice and two ruins, and a lavabo bowl and a patent, with the Church of the Redeemer, Orangeburg, South Carolina. Maybe a Bible and a prayer book too. And one day I pray that they're returned to their rightful owners.
You know? Anyway. The Lord will see to that, if that's going to happen. Anyway, people were left poor. Had a hard time. The Reverend Stiles Mellencamp, who was the rector at that time, after the war and in the recovery. The Yankees had stolen his mule, and he not only had Church of the Redeemer, but he had St. Matthew's Church up in Fort Mott, and he had to walk between churches to do services, but he did. He said people handled it bravely, and as people do here in the South when things are tough. And then in 1872, Mr. Mellencamp and Dr. Paul Trapier died, and there were a series of rectors, one after the other and after the other, names like Gary and Broadwell, Steele, Weston. You know, when you don't have much money to pay, you know, and you're going through those hard times, sometimes they just didn't keep priests very long. Everybody was having a hard time. Everybody was struggling. And I don't have to tell you, I'm going far afield here, but I don't have to tell you that the South was in poverty for 100 years after the Civil War. I don't think the South really began to come out of that poverty until after World War II. But that's another lecture, isn't it? Anyway, one thing happened that was momentous in 1891. I believe it was Reverend Williams, who served until 1893, who made the suggestion, and I think the congregation approved. And why they did, I'm not quite sure. Was it that they had just built a college for black folks across the street? I don't know. That's been mentioned to me before. Is that why they decided to move? I don't know. Was it that the railroad made too much noise? I don't know. Maybe. But in 1891, the congregation decided an amazing thing. To put that little church, to pump it up, to jack it up, and to wrap big cables around it and hitch those cables up to mules and pull the church up on logs. Pull the church up on one long log and then roll it a little bit, put another log under there, roll it a little bit, another log, roll it a little bit, another log. And after all, finally, when the first log comes out the end, you know, the men picked up the log, carried it to the front, put it there again. And they rolled that church on logs down Boulevard and then took a right on Russell Street and brought it to its present location here on Russell Street and put it on a foundation that had already been built for it and planted the Church of the Redeemer here. An amazing feat. They say it took 2 days. 2 days just to move the church. What engineering. What guts. And now that you're just getting tired and a little bit sleepy, I want to invite you to come into the church with me, if you would, please.
Here's the wall, the end of the building, and about right here was the altar table. Okay? Probably over here was the lectern. Over here was the pulpit. I mean, you know, not much space at all. And again, here, this is the first pew. This is the first pew that was back here. This was the congregation. Okay? And you walk in the front door, and here you are. All right? And that's how this church was in 1891 when it was moved here. Kind of interesting to remember that and to look back and think about the church and what happened next. What happened is that there began to be slow improvements. All right? Very slow improvements. What happened first is by about the early 1900s, about 1902, they built the church out this way without that transept. You know, that becomes a solid wall, that's a solid wall. They built the church out to here, with a new wall. Okay, because of the Oxford movement, they're deciding, okay, we need kind of a holier space. And so they added more pews, a few more pews. And then they got the choir up here on one side, and the other choir was down here. And then up about here was lifted up to about as high as this is over there. This is where the altar was. And then lectern and pulpit. Okay? So you have a bigger space. But by 1912, they pushed out the transept this way, and the transept that way, and then the statue made a statue there. And then they pushed out that way, and then a narthex to the church, and beyond that, a vestibule. Now, you can have a seat now, if you want, Have a seat for a second. Now I'm asking, what's the name of this video? Nothing comes from whole cloth. Everything comes from something. Remember that in the Jewish temple, the temple that Solomon made, the temple that was the architect that God showed to Moses, the tabernacle out in the wilderness, there was a place where you entered. And that place where you entered was where the people gathered. By the time the temple was built, that place where you gathered became the court of the Gentiles. And then you came in to the actual temple court where the sacrifices were being made. And then you had the gathering place for the Jewish men and the Jewish women on the sides. And then you had a curtain. And you had the holy place. The holy place in the temple where the priests came. Where there was the showbread and the altar of incense and the candelabra. And then finally, in the temple, you had the Holy of Holies behind the curtain where the Ark of the Covenant was. And the Ark of the Covenant there was the Ten Commandments and an ephah of the manna that they had out in the wilderness and Aaron's rod that was had in the wonderful box, the holy box. Well, like I said, nothing comes from just whole cloth. In the early Christian centuries, as early as 197, early 200s, there is a town that's been discovered along the Tigris and Euphrates River Valley, in Iraq, where in the same town they have a synagogue that looks like what I just described to you. It looked like a synagogue that looked like a temple. In the same town, you've got a church. And how do we know it's a church? Because it had crosses in it. And an altar. And it was under sand for almost 2,000 years. And it has icons of saints. Even going back that far. And so, why does the Christian church look the way it looks? Because of that ancient form. But Christianized, it's got the shape of a cross. One arm, the other, the head, the feet. You've got the doors that you come in from the out of the street into the vestibule, and then you come into the narthex, which is like the court of the Gentiles, and you come in here to the court of the men and the women, so we now sit together, all of us. And then you've got the sanctuary, the holy place, and finally the holy holies. So it all comes from somewhere, doesn't it? That's why church is the way it does. Because all the way back to the temple. Now, about the furnishings in this beautiful church. That window up there, it's lovely, isn't it? That is a Tiffany window. Made by Tiffany's studio. And there's a story about it. And I'll get out of the way while I tell you the story about it. It was given in honor of Miss Mary Raymond in Charleston, South Carolina, and it was given to one of the churches down there, and I forget which church it was, with a lovely picture of Jesus coming on the clouds, and angels on either side. I wish they were better lighted, but the middle is... Can you see the three cherubs up there? Lovely, isn't it? Well, that window was given by the Raymond family in the early 1900s to this church in Charleston, from Miss Mary Raymond, who was... born in 1789, died after the Civil War, okay? And they gave, the window was fully paid for, and the vestry refused to receive it. Refused to receive it. They said they didn't want to receive it because it did not say to the glory of God on that window. But most people say that's not the real reason. The real reason is that those, the faces of the three cherubs in the window above, those are the three children of Mary Raymond. And the parishioners remember those three children as spoiled brats, as hellions, and they didn't want to be looking at them every Sunday when they came to church. But of course, we don't know who they are, so we were happy to receive it. We received it, I heard it was a free gift. He said, sure, we'll take it. Tiffany Window, back in the early 1900s sometime. This window over here, if you can see it, if y'all can come down and take a look later if you want to, that's welcome. This window is not a Tiffany, but it's Tiffany-like, and it's lovely. And there's a story that sometime in, I think it was the 1930s or 40s, the windows on the side were here. And it's a lovely image of a shepherd and a sheep, and here is an empty tomb, an open tomb. And the rector, I heard, didn't like it at first. He didn't want to receive it. But they finally received it when someone pointed something out to him. Look at this open, empty tomb. And tell me if you don't see something unusual about it. I wonder if you'll catch it. What's unusual about it? Look at the scene. It's a square tomb that's open, is it? And then there's a stone rolled away. You see something curious about the stone that's rolled away? Well, someone pointed out to the rector that the stone was rolled uphill. We know in Scripture that an angel rolled the stone away, not to let Jesus out, he was already out, but to let people into the tomb to see that it was empty, okay? But if people were going to rob the grave, it was human beings who were doing it, they would have rolled the stone down, okay? It would have been an angel who said, oh no, rob, and moved uphill to make a point. It wasn't abandoned. Over here, now I really want you to take a look at this window. I want you to look at it closely when you get a chance. This window also is a Tiffany window. It is. It is a Tiffany window. And if you go down this aisle right here and go all the way down here to this last little tiny, tiny little rectangle here at the bottom of this window, you will see a name written, Louis O. Tiffany. Louis Tiffany did this window personally. He signed the ones that he personally did. And it's this breathtaking. Jesus calling Peter and Andrew to follow him. The moment when Peter says, oh boy, I'm a sinful man. I can't follow you. I'm a sinful man. You don't want him to do with me. And Jesus says, you follow me, and I'll teach you how to catch people. Well, lovely windows. Take a look. All these other windows, they were added through the years by people who love this church and love their families. Other beautiful stained glass windows to the left this way, that used to be the rector's office. To the other side, there used to be the secretary's office or where the vestry met at one time. In front of the vestibule has a beautiful stained glass window, a rose window over it. All given by people who love this church through the years. And I can read the names of all of these rectors who served this place, all the land that was acquired, you know, building the parish hall and the church school wing and then the teenagers wing and just all the things that they did. But it was all out of love for the Lord, for these people added to this church. All those years of priests who came and went. And we read names like Dr. William Snow, who was here for 25 years. Before him, Father Tisdale, Thomas Tisdale, in the 60s through the 40s, came in 1940 and stayed until 1964. William Snow, who stayed for 25 years, 1964 to 1989, and really built this church tremendously. Other priests like Bob Long, Dow Sanderson, Gail Retzloff, and here I am. I've been here 8 years. But I do nothing without the power of Jesus Christ in my life. I do nothing without building on the love and the work of others who came before. And that's how a church is, isn't it? You know? I will go on, and this place will be here. Others will move on. by God's grace. A testament to His love, to His presence, and to the faith and trust of faithful, godly people. Thank you for being here. Any questions? Comments? Yeah? You know, I wish I could answer that question. I cannot. But it is an old style, and I imagine that they've been here since the very early 1900s, maybe even late 1800s. Yeah? But I really can't answer that question. Wish I could. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Do you have a special group or a method? How you preserved this basically all wooden church?
You know, that's a good question.
All these years.
Yeah. One thing I forgot to mention, always something, is that very early in the 1900s when it was expanding, you know, after the expansion in 1912, then it was bricked in. So the brick, you know, it's a brick church now, right? It was bricked over. And the brick helped protect. But other than people just daily cleaning and trying to keep it up, I mean, there have been very few other renovations, as far as I know. Since I've been here, the vestibule, the place where you first walk in, had some sags in it. It was, you know, had some little tile, and it wasn't looking too good. So they went in basically and redid the subfloor, and then built it up from that, and then now it's, you know, beautiful flagstone. And it's really pretty in there. But other than that, just routine upkeep. Oh, and you know, termite control.
Very important.
And God's grace. Any other questions?
How many can you seat in the...
About 285, I think. About 285. We've only had one funeral that where it was truly filled.
How many of the pews are really old?
Let's see. I believe these were the pews that are present 1930s, I believe. I think that's about as far back as they go. So I'm not sure about that. Someone else may know more than I do. Miss Winnie, do you?
Okay.
Pretty old.
They go back a few years. Are these high?
I believe they are. Yes.
Beautiful.
Oh, it's gorgeous. Yeah. Though I guess I do have one slight tale to tell again. You notice the lovely white sanctuary. It was, I believe, in the early 1930s that a priest came in and said, because the sanctuary looked like this, the beadboard. And the priest said, "No, we can't have that. Too dark." And he came in and he got a plaster over all of it. Okay? And to make it white, like it is. But it's up to you. It's up to the beholder. I mean, would it have been better to keep it the way it was, you know, the beadboard all the way up? Or is the white, does it work? All to the glory of God. It does focus it, doesn't it? But that, it's interesting about that in church. And the carpet, it should be blue. No, I like the red. No, it should be brown. No carpet at all. We should have this. Wooden floors. I mean, right? You know, we talk about talking about churches. So what taste do you prefer? Any other questions? Comments? Thank you.
Thank you.
quite welcome. You're quite welcome. And if I can, I'd like to close us with a prayer and a blessing. Is that okay? Let us pray. Direct us, O Lord, in all our doings with thy most gracious favor. And further us with thy continual help, and in all our works, begun, continued, and ended in thee, we may glorify thy holy name, and finally, by thy mercy, obtain everlasting life through Jesus Christ our Lord. And the blessing of God Almighty, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost be amongst you and remain with you this night and forevermore. Amen. God bless y'all.
Thank you.
We're going to need a copy of the talk on the blessing.